Good morning and welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, partner in charge of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. We created the center in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. Find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at www.businessofgovernment.org. The Business of Government Hour features a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. Our conversation this morning is with John Seal, Chief Management Officer of the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Paul. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. And joining us in our conversation is Dennis Kayser. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Paul.
Well, John, let's start by talking about the historical background of the PBGC. Could you describe its mission to us and sort of, you know, when and why was it created?
The corporation, which is a government corporation, was created in 1974 to ensure private sector defined benefit pension plans. Now, those are the kinds of pension plans that are sometimes viewed as traditional company pension plans. They're usually negotiated between a company and a union and provide benefits to retirees based on age and years of employment. About a decade before PBGC was created, the Studebaker car company, it used to be called Studebaker Packard, I think, went out of business, and about 4,000 retirees or workers and retirees in that company had a pension plan that was underfunded. And because the company was well known, because there was no insurance for the pension plan, a lot of concern was generated at that time. And even though the legislation setting up the corporation didn't come until a decade later, it really acted as the catalyst for providing pension insurance, because many of the workers not only lost their jobs, but they also lost most of their pensions.
Where's PBGC in the context of the Department of Labor worries about employees, Commerce worries about business, Treasury worries about all things tax-related? Where does PBGC fit?
Well, actually, the secretaries of those three departments make up our board of directors, with the Secretary of Labor as the chair. And so we have a lot of interaction with all three departments in terms of our own corporate governance. But also program-wise, we have relationships with the IRS and with the Department of Labor.
And how's the PBGC funded?
We don't receive any taxpayer general revenue funds at all. We basically have four sources of funding. First, we do get premiums, insurance premiums, if you will, from ongoing pension plans. And that amounted to almost $1 billion last year in terms of revenues, a little bit over 31,000 defined benefit pension plans that are in our system. Second, for those underfunded pension plans that we take over, that we become trustee of, we not only take on their liabilities, but we also take over their assets. And so that provides additional revenues for us. And then we invest the assets of those plans as well as the premiums that we collect each year. So we have investment earnings. And then fourth, we do get some proceedings from bankruptcy hearings and decisions from bankrupt companies as a creditor.
John, I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about the people that work for the PBGC. First, can you tell us how many people actually work for the corporation, and then talk a little bit about some of the unique skills they may have?
In terms of the federal government, we're a relatively small agency. We only have 800 federal employees, but we also have about 1,200 contract staff that work with us. Most of our staff are located in Washington, although we also have 11 field offices that handle benefit processing for us, and all 11 of those field offices are contract staff. Probably the five most significant types of jobs that we have would be what you would expect sort of in the pension world. They would be auditors, actuaries, attorneys, pension law specialists, and IT specialists.
So that helps us understand a little bit about the organization and the people. What are the responsibilities of the chief management officer?
There's a little grab bag of responsibilities. I'm responsible for strategic planning for the corporation, for budget, for procurement, for facilities support, for obtaining feedback from our customers through surveys or focus groups, and for human resources. And in that capacity, I also serve as the chief human capital officer for the corporation.
The CMO seems like a unique position in government agencies. Do you think this is something other agencies should be trying to also do? And what are some of the pros and cons of the CMO position?
Well, my position was actually new to the corporation. It was created shortly after I came to the corporation in 1993. And the idea behind it was to try to bring some concerted emphasis to management initiatives and coordination of key management functions within the corporation, which had been split apart previously. And interestingly enough, I had served in a similar kind of a role several years before when I was at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission as their management director. And I would say the advantages are that you're able to bring together some discrete functions, perhaps to work more closely together, such as perhaps budget and procurement. Or another classic would be strategic planning and budget, which is one of the emphases in the president's management agenda. Rather than having sort of two separate processes, we've now been able to integrate the two quite well. And having someone responsible for both areas, I think, just generally helps organizationally. Whether it's something I would recommend for other agencies, I think that really depends on the individual agency, its size, and its culture. It used to be many years ago that cabinet departments had assistant secretaries for administration or management that had all of these functions, plus finance and information technology. And over the years, there's been a splitting up of those functions in at least the large agencies and to a certain extent smaller agencies out of the concern of having more senior attention paid to individual functions. So I think an agency's got to weigh that, having more high-level specialized attention in certain areas and match that up with perhaps less coordination of the activities of the different functions.
John, you touched a little bit on your previous experiences. Can you talk a little bit more about your experiences prior to joining the PBGC?
I've been bounced around in about six different agencies in my career. Started off in the Pentagon working for the Air Force as a presidential summer intern, where I learned to love Washington. I also knew that I wanted to work for a smaller organization. So after I got out of grad school, I was able to work in the Office of Management and Budget for several years as a budget analyst, and was fortunate enough to be informally mentored as a relatively new federal employee, and also had the advantage of overseeing several different agencies over the years that I was in OMB. And from there, I was asked to become a deputy assistant secretary in the Department of Education, which was just forming under the Carter administration. And so I headed up the program and management analysis area at the Education Department. The administration changed when President Reagan got elected, and for about a half year I served as the assistant secretary for management. And then I was asked to go over to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, become the management director there for several years, then moved to an agency that is now the Corporation for National Service. At the time it was called ACTION, which had voluntary domestic programs sort of similar to the Peace Corps overseas, and served as the chief of staff in that agency, became the acting director of the agency again when the administration changed and President Clinton was elected. And then about a half year later, I was asked to come over to PBGC to become the chief management officer.
It was interesting the way you described your experiences initially at the Pentagon, wanting to move to interested in smaller agencies, because as I was reading your background, I understand that you're the founder of the Small Agency Council.
Yes.
Could you tell us about that?
Sure. That actually started off while I was at EEOC, and it was very much a grassroots kind of a development, if you will. A few people who were responsible for management functions, counterparts of mine, if you will, in small agencies began to talk to one another and express their common frustration that they might learn of a new government-wide management policy by seeing it in the Washington Post versus having any opportunity to have input when it was in a drafting stage, and sort of being behind the information curve, if you will, of what any administration was trying to advocate in terms of management initiatives. There were actually a couple of sort of attempts to create rump groups, if you will, of chief management officials and agencies. Didn't get very far. They sort of fell apart over time. And then a handful of us tried again, and we were able to get recognition from OMB this time in terms of an organization that OMB would recognize and respond to. And that actually gave us impetus. We became a member of the President's Council on Management Improvement, which at the time was the collection of assistant secretaries for administration and cabinet departments. And then it grew quite rapidly over time. We now have over 80 small agencies represented on the Small Agency Council. They range anywhere from close to 6,000 people, which is sort of the upper limit that OMB defined for us as small, to as few as 3 people. And you would be surprised, about half of the membership, about 40 agencies, have 100 or fewer employees. That came, I think, as a surprise to many government officials once we start to talk about our membership. And so the council really has 3 sort of goals. One is to interact with the central management agencies like OMB or GSA or OPM on their policies to try to provide a small agency perspective to them on their management policies. Second, it's just share good information, management information amongst one another so that we can foster improvements in those agencies. And third, to a limited extent, we actually share resources. One of the things that we've done now for well over a decade is annually agencies contribute anywhere from $500 to $5,000 towards a centralized training program for small agency staff. And this again started out back in the 80s when Graham Rudman, the Deficit Reduction Act, began to squeeze domestic agency budgets. And in many instances, training got cut or eliminated, especially in small agencies. And it was out of that growing awareness of small agencies that they were failing in terms of developing their employees that this volunteer sort of a program started. Today, we sponsor over 24 training programs ranging from management training to sort of common skills kinds of training. Any small agency can nominate employees to attend those. And we've got over 50 agencies contributing over $100,000 in total towards the program each year now. And it's very unique because it's the only program that I know of where federal agencies voluntarily contribute. They aren't told to contribute. And the whole program is based on whether or not it's delivering a product that's worthwhile. If it's not worthwhile, the agencies won't contribute, obviously.
That's interesting, especially the voluntary nature. What happens when a pension plan ends and the PBGC steps in? We'll ask John Seale of the PBGC to explain this when the Business of Government Hour returns.